party, people. Good morning. I am your host, Jason Miles, and this is Revolution Podcast. And this is my final week of my quote-unquote vacation. We're using that term very, very loosely. It's more of a, it was supposed to be a bit of a break. So let me give you a heads up on what happened on this episode. So in this episode, this is the audio only of the live stream we did with two of some of my favorite economist friends that are show regulars, if you will. Dr. Asitar Baer, that's become a bit of a Twitter phenomenon in recent months. And Dr. Jack Rasmus, an OG Marxist economist. And whenever I do these shows, I send out these calendar invites because, honestly, it just reminds me on my calendar that I have shows that are coming up and who's the guest. And a big reason for me doing that was because I used to do the live stream and a totally different audio-only podcast. It was a totally different show. And then Pascal and I had a sit down and he was like, you know, that's just too much. That's just too much. Just go ahead and we'll just dump the audio from the shows and that'll be the audio. I'm like, all right. And so when I send the calendar invite out, there's a Zoom link on it that comes automatic. So our guest, who is used to doing Zoom, he's still teaching, and he's teaching via Zoom. So, of course, he'd see a Zoom link and think, this is the link. So when I sent another email and said, this is the link, it got a little confusing. So our guest is a little late on the show, and I'm taking full responsibility for why the guest was late. And being actually a little under the weather, I was asleep. And I woke up to messages on my phone of, oh no, the guest isn't here. And I was like, oh shit. So luckily you guys can't see me panicking in the background. Probably everybody that was off screen was panicking in the background. But knowing Dr. Jack from several appearances on the show, he comes right in and doesn't F around. That's why I love I kept warning Pascal. I was like, Dr. Jack he's a real one. I was like, you're going to like this guy. And sure enough, after the show, Pascal was like, okay. And another thing, we knew Dr. Baer couldn't stay late. Sorry, still under the weather. For the bonus patron after hour segment. So when Gene thought the guest wasn't going to show, he's scrambling around for somebody for the after hours. Dr. Baer got sent the same question, so he knew what we wanted to talk about. But what we wanted to discuss was a lot of Dr. Jack Rasmus's writings. He writes a weekly blog on his own website. He also has a radio show on Counterpunch. He's written several books on the Reagan years, the Obama years, neoliberalism, empire. So I was excited to have both these guys on. And Asitar Baer also knows of Dr. Jack's work and is a bit of an admirer of his work. As is another economist that used to come on the show a lot more, Arash Kalahi. And that's kind of how I met a lot of these leftist economists, through Arash and his work. So I knew Dr. Jack was going to be fire. I knew he wasn't going to mess around and mince words. And considering you can What you can't see, and luckily what you can't hear, is kind of the worry and frustration when someone doesn't show up or show up on time. And Pascal handled it beautifully. Jean Bajelan, who's been helping out with the back-end production, handled it beautifully. So enjoy this show. It's very informative. I mean, Asitar Bear is a great economist. And a very smooth way of delivering what his lessons, right? Dr. Jack has that old school tone in his voice and is just raw and uncut, and Pascal was loving it. Asitar, for the short time he was there, was loving it. And then if you are a patron, the bonus patron after hours, we brought Derek Varn on, and there was a bit of a MMT discussion they had, because that was the final question on the main show. And they definitely got a lot more in depth on MMT, a lot more in depth on China, a lot more in depth on just empire in general. So if you want to hear the bonus patron end, there's only one way. Become a patron. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. And you can get more content like this. Oh, that is my cue. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for making this one of the top podcasts on Apple Podcasts. It's pretty cool. YouTube.com/ThisIsRevolutionPodcast. Subscribe. And I am out.
Evening and welcome to This Is Revolution Podcast. I am your acting host, Pascal Robert. For those of you that have already figured it out, our normal host, Jason Miles, is still on vacation, catching those beautiful California sun rays, and he will be back on with us hopefully Friday, if not definitely by Saturday. I'd like to thank those of you who are regular viewers of the show in our chat as well as our audience. Please subscribe on YouTube, hit the bell, share our show with your friends and the like, become a patron, and don't forget those super chats, and also join us on Discord where we jump on regularly every now and then to say hello to our patrons as well. Today's show, we are going to be talking about economics, Biden's agenda, infrastructure, and is Biden really, really the quote-unquote new FDR? Before we introduce our guest, we are going to share with you our intro video made by our wonderful host, Jason Miles, who even while away is working to make our show better and better. So, hey, on to the video clip.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world. The third is freedom from want, which translated into world terms means economic understanding, which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world. The fourth is freedom from fear, which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armament to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
In recent months, there has emerged a narrative that has sought to frame Joe Biden's presidency as a revival of FDR New Dealism. To what extent is this narrative realistic? Is Joe Biden really a deviation from the neoliberal economic order that has defined the 50-year counter-revolution? Or is such talk merely a DC Beltway branding exercise? We'll ask these questions and more. This is Revolution.
When I was 17 years old, like many of you, I participated in sit-ins to desegregate the restaurants and movie houses of Wilmington, Delaware.
I come out of the civil rights movement. I was one of those guys that sat in and marched and all that stuff.
During the 60s, I was, in fact, very concerned about the civil rights movement. I was not an activist. I worked at an all-black swimming pool in the east side of Wilmington, Delaware. I was involved. I was involved in what they were thinking, what they were feeling. I was involved, but I was not out marching. I was not down in Selma. I was not anywhere else. I was a suburbanite kid who got a dose of exposure to what was happening to black Americans when I'm in my own city.
This nation has placed its destiny in the hands and heads and hearts of its millions of free men and women, and its faith in freedom under the guidance of God. Freedom means the supremacy of human rights everywhere. Our support goes to those who struggle to gain those rights and keep them. Our strength is our unity of purpose to that high concept. There can be no end. Save victory.
Well, all right. Another thought-provoking intro video put together by our man on vacation, Jason Miles. So our guest for today, who is going to be our co-host, but who we have right now, longtime friend of the show, our recurring guest, Asita Bear, professor of economics, and we are going to bring him on now to discuss this hefty subject, and hopefully he can help us with our analysis. Let's hear it for Dr. Asita Bear.
Hey, Pascal. Thanks for having me on the show. Always
no
enjoy.
No problem, yeah. Dr. Bear. I do not have the applause soundboard that Jason uses, so do not feel that you have been gypped in any way for not having those applause.
Everyone has to use their imagination, fill that in, that sound in themselves, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. We are waiting for our second guest, hopefully Dr. Jack Matt Rasmus, who is also an economist Hopefully he will have the ability to sign on sometime in the near future, in the immediate future, I should say. But nonetheless, we should get back straight to the topic at hand. Dr. Asitar Bear, if you can, my first question for you is that before we even get to the FDR rigmarole, is Biden's economic agenda or policy even truly a deviation from the neoliberal economic order that we have seen in what we call here at This Is a Revolution podcast, the 50-year counter-revolution?
No, of course not. I mean, it's very much of a piece with, you know, the Reagan-style governance that we've had since 1980. I mean, it's, you know, the policies are neoliberal, right? I mean, that's the dressing is different, you know, the style is different. We have, but the substance is the same, you know. I mean, the language is a little bit different. Maybe some of the promises are a little bit different, but, you know, it doesn't amount to anything. I mean, I think, you know, Marxists are fond of looking at what are the real material benefits, right? I mean, like, you can't eat words, you know? So, you know, what is actually being delivered here? And I think it's pretty clear that what's being delivered is more of the same, you know? Like, we have to look at the continuity between figures like Trump and Biden, not get caught up on the surface level where it seems like there's been some kind of, you know, break or something. I don't see that on a level of substantive policy.
Well, what do you say about the massive policy, wealth distribution that came about as a result of the CARES Act? We have now somewhere between 1.5 to 3.5 billion dollars, I think trillion dollars actually, is being discussed regarding the infrastructure bill, Biden's child care subsidies. I've been touted as some to be the greatest thing since the Great Society in terms of their ability to address child poverty. True, Biden did not decrease the minimum wage. True, Biden did not give any kind of massive loan forgiveness across the board for student loan debt, but he did promise to give, I believe, a few hundred billion dollars of student loan debt for disabled students. What about, for example, the fact that Biden did, he didn't give us the eviction moratorium, but he didn't fight it when the CDC actually requested for it. Wouldn't that be grounds to at least say that compared to the hardcore neoliberal corporate privateer Democratic presidents we've had from Clinton and Obama, maybe even going back to Carter, that Biden is somewhat of a deviation from that tradition?
I would say substantively, no, I wouldn't. You know, I mean, let's look at something like the, you know, kids in cages, right? I mean, like, we're seeing a lot of continuity there, you know? If we talk about the infrastructure bill, you know, infrastructure is one of these things, there's an ongoing need for that, right? I mean, like, you have to just spend money just to maintain the roads and bridges and, you know, water systems and all of this stuff, right? And a lot of that, you know, like, the reality of the last few decades is that we haven't been spending at a pace that even maintains, right? So the infrastructure is being degraded, you know? I mean, like, all of this stuff, all these assets, you know, nothing lasts forever, right? So we have to be replacing, you know, I mean, people have been talking about the need for trillion-dollar infrastructure bills for a long, long time, right? Okay, now we have, you know, this is a situation where it's like snow builds up on a leaf, and eventually it falls off, right? You know, like, I mean, so whether that happens under a Democratic administration or a Republican administration, you know, I don't see that as some kind of, you know, oh my, you know, wow, you know, Biden is now, you know, some kind of FDR Keynesian type of figure who is, you know, ready to unleash the entire might of the federal government to create full employment. I don't see that as happening. I see this as, long overdue infrastructure spending. Again, it's been talked about for a long time in DC and in policy circles, but the can has been kicked down the road a long way too. So, you know, here we are. I don't think we're seeing a substantively different kind of infrastructure bill either under Biden than we would see under a Republican administration. You know, I mean, the problem with a lot of federal spending is, you know, the way it's distributed, right? I mean, like it overwhelmingly goes toward, you know, the largest and richest corporations. So, I mean, it's like there's a million mechanisms under capitalism to redistribute wealth upwards, right? And government spending successfully does that, right? So do we need the infrastructure spending though? Right? Of course we do, you know, like we have a problem of crumbling infrastructure. And, you know, that's indisputable. So it's like we want to support the spending, but also recognize there's far better ways to do this. You know, I mean, that's kind of my answer.
So, okay, so your general point is that there's probably not going to be much distinction between how Biden will be handling his infrastructure agenda compared to how Trump would handle his infrastructure agenda. What do you think about the presence of, quote unquote, the progressives that we have in Congress, i.e. Bernie Sanders and the squad, in their capacity to extract more progressive policy concessions from Biden in terms of how funds are distributed or allocated, in terms of who gets contracts for infrastructure development, or the amounts of infrastructure resources that are dedicated to other social policies and programs that are perhaps redistributive in nature, or at least interested in public goods governance? Do you think that having Sanders, the squad, or any of that variety of congressional personnel overseeing this process would perhaps lead to more goods and services coming out of that bill than we would get from a Trump?
Pascal, you must have read Kwame Ture on liberals. You know, like, I mean, I think this is where I go with it. You know, I mean, I think we have to look at how much power do these people have. You know, I mean, and the answer is almost none. You know, I mean, they get a lot of attention. I mean, I think this is the contradiction with somebody like AOC. It's such a surprise, and she becomes such a huge celebrity, right? But does that celebrity translate into influence in DC? Does it translate into influence in the legislature? I mean, no, it doesn't, right? I mean, so you have this kind of spectacle. I mean, what gives you influence? You know, you need to be on influential committees, right? I mean, you need to be able to, like, you know, work together to craft legislation. You know, what I see is this, like, progressive squad and whatever. It's pretty isolated. I don't see them moving the needle on legislation. You know, that's my observation. Maybe I'm wrong. Please alert me if I'm wrong in the chat here. I'm sure you guys will anyway. So I think that, you know, this is a kind of symbolic, you know, move, or, you know, to have a kind of visible sign of dissent or a progressivism. It doesn't seem to really translate into any kind of policy change. I mean, I wish there was a long list of policy successes that we can point to. Even Bernie himself, you know, his successes have been, let's put the occasional rider on something. And, you know, like, I don't want to minimize that. That's good work, right? But it's, you know, it's throwing a handful of sand at a tidal wave in the grand scheme of things, right? It's not going to meaningfully slow down that wave. So I see the actions there as pretty symbolic.
Okay, so you really don't see that bearing any fruition. And you don't find any, perhaps, you know, reason to be sanguine in terms of Biden's CARES Act policy at all, particularly the child allotment subsidies for parents and the allegation that it's an anti-child poverty measure that we haven't seen since the Great Society, which is being touted. Of course, you are hearing all of these constant. By the way, I'm not making these. I don't want to say. I don't like using the term devil's advocate because the devil doesn't need anyone to advocate for him. But I'm just trying to provide a counter to the narrative to at least try to seem like we're being fair and balanced here. And you know, even though my personal opinions are inclined more to agree with you, I do want it to make it be known that we are trying to at least give a fair assessment of the argument that Biden is somehow leveraging an economic agenda that disturbs the traditional quote-unquote neoliberal playing field that we've been on, and at least is seemingly more Keynesian. So you don't find any reason to be sanguine in that the CARES Act as well regarding the anti-child poverty measures that have been argued by some to be the greatest thing we've seen since the Great Society.
I think it's sad how, you know, destroyed we kind of have been on a movement level that we accept those crumbs as a major effort of any kind, you know. That to me is sad, you know. I mean, we to say, okay, look, we're not getting health care for all. We're not even getting Medicare for all. The best that we could maybe hope for is lowering the age of Medicare enrollment. Like, I mean, talk about things that don't solve the problem, right? I mean, okay, so it's great if we do a little bit to mitigate child poverty, but we could eliminate poverty. I mean, that's the in the grand scheme of things, like, why do we have poverty at all, right? Why do we have homelessness at all? Why is medical bankruptcy the single biggest cause of bankruptcy in this country? I mean, you know, we need to ask the big questions and not think, oh, we have to be practical and we have to tinker around the edges that, you know, we have to, you know, it's like this machine, capitalism, this machine that grinds up people, and people are saying, gosh, if we oil this machine and take care of it really well, you know, it'll be a little more efficient. And it's like, what? We don't want a more efficient people grinder, you know? We need to retune the entire economy so that it actually serves human need, not a little bit less savagely redistributes wealth toward the rich, right? I mean, because that's what we're talking about, you know? When we say, okay, we're going to reduce child poverty, well, why do we have poverty, right? We have poverty because we have all of these mechanisms in the economy which redistribute wealth upward. It's not a mystery, you know. I mean, like, it drives me up a wall because people are always saying, oh, capitalism lifts people out of poverty. Sorry, but that's bullshit, right? Capitalism produces poverty. You can't create vast fortunes without creating deprivation. I mean, that's the math, you know. That's the root issue. You know, I like politics and, you know, I like knowing the details of it and whatever. But we have to kind of keep the bigger picture in view, I think.
So here's a question I want to ask you, and this is a serious question. Do we think that we're in a position right now where because of the fear, maybe some would say paranoia, of an impending reactionary right with the existence of the Trump reactionaries that we have in Congress, Trump, you know, waiting in the wings to perhaps run in 2024. What do you think about the argument that some would make that the job of anyone to the left of the Republicans, the reactionary Republicans, is to engage in a popular front or united front type politics with the liberal Democrats and basically join with them in their attempt to assure that the reactionaries do not take power and to basically try to get the best that we can to maintain a democratic society for fear of impending fascism?
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of, you know, the vote blue no matter who type of argument. I think we're just reaching the limits of that kind of discourse. I think that, you know, to say that we can prevent fascism through, you know, moderate means or through centrism, well, first of all, this has never worked historically, right? You know, fascism emerges out of the contradictions of capitalism, right? It emerges because, you know, we have all of these different crises that occur, from, you know, falling profit rates, you know, to unsuccessful attempts to mitigate that through imperialism, right? So in Germany, for example, right, Germany was more cut off from the ability to conquer, for example, Africa, right, than were other major European powers. You know, they were able to do some, right? But in terms of capturing these vast surpluses that other European powers did, the Germans found themselves disadvantaged in that competitive struggle to colonize, right? And so, you know, how do they manage their contradictions, right? Like, you know, Marx and Lenin and, you know, the whole Marxist tradition, right, talks about imperialism as a way to deal with the contradictions of capitalism. So, you know, we have that now, right? Are we going to see, you know, is centrism going to mitigate those contradictions? Well, probably not. I don't think it is, right? I mean, but the centrists don't have, I don't think they have the kind of energy, right? The juice. If you look at like, who's got that? Well, there's certainly, you know, racist, misogynist, right-wing reactionaries absolutely have a lot of energy right now, right? But that's a negative sign. That's horrible, right? But who else has energy, right? I mean, socialists and communists have a lot of energy right now. I mean, I'm seeing people are getting radicalized like crazy, right? I think it would be a mistake to not observe that, you know, to not see, wow, something is happening here. You know, there's a kind of a heightening of contradictions. And, you know, I mean, that has to do again with the material conditions, right? We have millions of people at risk of eviction. And the most of the discourse is like, well, should we slow that down a little bit? Should we, you know, we're already giving massive amounts of handouts and bailouts to landlords, you know, so I think that this isn't a moment of moderation. You know, we see moderation that emerges, you know, usually emerges after some kind of huge conflict, right? Where people are just like, oh my God, we're exhausted by this, right? I don't think that's the moment that we're in. I think we're in the precursor to a big conflict, not in the post. And I mean, what I see historically is that the only kind of ideology that's going to be able to successfully defend or defeat fascism is communism, right? I mean, because this is an ideology, it's very strong, right? And you need that. It's very clear. Here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to create a decent life for everyone. Centrism doesn't give us that, right? Centrism says, well, okay, we want everyone gets an opportunity, right? Everyone gets the ability to have a job or whatever, right? I mean, we can look at the actual history. How has this come down? And, you know, we can see that that promise has been an extremely hollow one, right? Because what the neoliberal agenda has done is deindustrialized, right? It's killed, you know, towns and, you know, urban centers, and, right, it's hollowed out the manufacturing base in the United States, for example, right? It's hard for me to see that as like a promising way forward. I think people are just, you know, like, well, the promises that have been made by neoliberals just have not been delivered.
So in your position, the Popular Front, United Front strategy basically has us coalescing around moderation instead of coming forth with the radical kind of politics that are going to be necessary to confront these reactionaries when they try to take power, and that we actually need more of a support for a more radical, revolutionary, transformative left flank than we do in coalescing around and supporting neoliberal or corporate centers of the liberal political establishment, which is the Democratic Party. I mean, I don't disagree with that in theory per se, but the question that I would ask as someone who was on the left, has been writing on the left for, you know, over a decade, is that do we have the cadre? Do we have the cadre on the left? Have we penetrated the ideological superstructure of American society, the consciousness of most American people in terms of where their politics are, to have them even recognize that there is a left? Because if you look in terms of just the media that the average American consumes, I can tell you that it's not stuff that is of the This Is Revolution podcast nature. It's much more in line with, you know, Ben Shapiro, Jordan Peterson, and a lot of the stuff on the reactionary right.
Yeah.
So as much as you would argue, and I don't disagree with you, because if we look at the overall span of time that we've had in this 50-year counter-revolution, yes, capitalist realism had taken hold in our lifetimes, you and I, Dr. Bear, particularly in the 80s and 90s and the early aughts, into an extent that you didn't even have the concept of talking about socialism as an alternative seemed almost comical. So compared to those periods of time, absolutely, I agree with you. Not to beat a dead horse with a phrase, but yes, the Overton window has expanded in that more people are embracing the ideas of challenging capitalism, questioning whether or not we're in a crisis of capitalism, considering socialism, without a doubt. But how we translate that into a politics in which we do not have to coalesce with the liberals, neoliberals, or corporatists in order to challenge or fight the reactionary right, when our side is so flaccid, is something I have to be seen. Anyway, I just got the notification that our main guest, Professor Jack Rasmus, is here, and we would like to actually add him to the board. Professor, retired Professor Emeritus Jack Rasmus, economist, please welcome to This Is Revolution podcast. Dr. Jack Rasmus, how are you, sir? Nope, we don't have his audio. Gene, can we work out his audio? Can you say something for us, Dr. Rasmus? We still do not have no audio. Can we fix that? You can hear us, Dr. Rasmus. Oh. This is problematic. For some reason, we cannot get you. Doc, can you try to unmute yourself? Maybe you are muted. Go to settings on your screen. Oh, well, if you look at the chat, we will have our producer Gene will help you out. Until then, we can continue with Asitar. The circle at the bottom of the right, which says it looks like a little like a turnkey under the screen where you see the image. It says settings. Does not see it. We are having technical difficulties. Continue. Well, we will fix it. We'll continue with Professor Asitar Bear. We'll have our production assistant Gene work on that. So Professor Bear, how exactly do we get this, if maybe not to be pejorative, nominal left to be able to influence politics enough so that we stop this urge to, quote unquote, create a popular front, united front with the neoliberals, with the centrists and the corporatists out of fear or paranoia of the reactionary right?
Can you hear me now?
We can. Ah, there we go. Dr. Rasmus, sorry for the technical difficulties that we had. We spent the early part of the moment, and maybe we can double down, because I know that Professor Asitar Bear has to leave early, assessing whether or not Biden's economic agenda is truly a departure from the 50-year counter-revolution of neoliberal economics that has been the mainstay of American economic policy. Dr. Asitar Bear tells us it is not a deviation, even with all of the prognostication of Biden being the new FDR and being Keynesian and all of that other blather, Dr. Asadar Pierre says that this is not remotely a deviation. What say you, Professor Rasmus?
Well, I have to agree with that. Basically, it's not a deviation from neoliberalism. You know, neoliberalism is a combination of four policies, really. It's fiscal policy of a certain kind. It's monetary policy of a certain kind. It's industrial policy, in other words, wages, benefits, unions, and privatization and so forth. And it's a trade, external policy, you know, interest rates and the value of the dollar and trade deficits and so forth. Those are the four policy elements, and there really is no fundamental change here. If you look at Biden's fiscal policy, what do we got? We've got some spending. The CARES Act, actually $1.1 trillion of spending. I won't go through the particulars. People probably know what the elements of that were, with the checks and the unemployment benefits and so forth, right? We have a tax policy. That's a fiscal policy, too. And then we have a monetary policy through the Federal Reserve, the central bank. That makes up Bidenomics, as you might call it, so far. And all three of those are still very much part of neoliberalism. If you look at the tax part, you know, the CARES Act was $650 billion in tax cuts, again, coming on Trump's $4.5 trillion. So that's no change, because most of it went to large businesses and investors, and that's part of tax policy under neoliberalism. If you look at the monetary policy, the Federal Reserve, that provided supposedly about $1.3 trillion in loans for medium and large businesses. But the medium and large businesses didn't take up those loans. So the Fed only provided $175 billion in new loans to medium and large businesses. They didn't take up the loans because they were fat with cash. They had raised trillions of dollars through low interest rates, which is neoliberal, caused by a lot of money injections into the economy. What corporations did when COVID hit was they issued trillions of dollars in new corporate bonds and raised money that way. They raised money by calling in their credit lines with the banks and loans. They save money in terms of expenditures on facilities and so forth. So they're really historically fat with cash. The idea of subsidizing corporations and bankers through monetary policy, free money, QE as they call it, is very much a liberal policy. A neoliberal policy. And of course, that's been continued, in spades here with Biden's policy. So that leaves us with, spending on social programs. Is that really a departure from neoliberalism? Well, we see when there's always a crisis, an extreme crisis, what neoliberal policy means is they will throw some money at households. In order to placate and prevent the crisis from, ending up in severe political reaction. And that's exactly what they did. But neoliberal policy always means, once you've done that and the crisis seems to dissipate, let's take that money back. And that's what's going on now. They've discontinued, the unemployment benefits. That's one way. They're not giving any more checks. That's another way. They're not really going to provide any more rental assistance. So we got a kind of creeping austerity in social spending. And that's neoliberal. That's very much neoliberal, creeping austerity. You know, during Obama, he comes up with $787 billion in 2009. That was his rescue program. $288 billion of that was tax cuts for businesses and investors. So you could take that away. We had about the rest, $300-400 billion in this actual fiscal spending, somehow, short term, long term, going to households. So about $500 billion actual stimulus going to households, fiscal spending. But then a couple of years after that, in August 2011, Obama agrees to take back $1.5 trillion in social program cuts. So they give a half a trillion, they take a trillion and a half back. They didn't take back anything for defense spending, which, of course, is also neoliberal. So when you look at the specifics, fiscal, tax, spending, monetary policy, there's nothing really apart from neoliberal here. There's nothing fundamentally different. So it's very much still within the tradition of neoliberal fiscal and monetary policy.
One of the things that you just highlighted, Professor Rasmus, which I appreciated that when I was reading your blog, is that Biden gave corporate tax cut to companies, which is something I've never heard anyone address, highlight, or even discuss. Why is the urge so great for people to make Biden seem like some kind of progressive policy champion when he's giving corporate tax cuts in a pandemic while people are being denied $15 minimum wage extension payments on their $600 a month and everything else?
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, the CARES Act was $650 billion in tax cuts. You hardly hear anything about that, you see. They keep that pretty quiet. And that comes on the tail of Trump's $4.5 trillion tax cuts in December 2017. They say that was $1.5 trillion, but it was really $4.5 trillion because of the way they made assumptions about economic growth and the way they hid the tax cut for U.S. multinational corporations offshore. So instead of rolling that back to pay for these programs, you know, he just went along with it. Congress, by the way, went along with it. Why? Because of the influence of corporations, lobbyists in Congress. And whenever major legislation like the CARES Act last year was up for grabs, you know, they want a piece of the action. They wanted more tax cuts, and they got it. We've been cutting taxes in this country for 20 years now. And my estimations are we've cut $15 trillion in business and investor tax cuts since 2001. We had about $5 trillion under George Bush. We had more under Barack Obama than even under George Bush, because Barack Obama had his own tax cuts, and he continued the Bush tax cuts for 10 years. And then we have Trump coming in on top of that with $4.5 trillion in tax cuts. So it's $15 trillion in tax cuts here. And by the way, you know, this is the first time in U.S. history we ever cut taxes while we were engaging in wars. Usually we raise taxes somewhat to help partly pay for the wars, but we spend $7 trillion on wars in the Middle East and Central Asia. Why we cut taxes by $15 trillion? So there's $22 trillion in national debt right there. That's neoliberalism as well. In other words, let's run up the national debt with these deficits. As long as the expenditures are in the form of tax cuts to capital incomes and spending on defense. So it's still all very neoliberal. And, you know, an addendum to that is Biden started out saying during the election that he was going to raise corporate taxes, right, to help pay for these programs. Well, what has he done? He didn't do any of that. There's no increase in corporate taxes to pay for the infrastructure bill. That's all smoke and mirrors. He said he was going to raise the corporate tax from 21 under Trump to 28%. He backed off of that. And then he agrees with the European and other countries to cut the minimum tax to 15%. Well, you know, when the tax in this country for corporations is 21% and it's offshore for 15%, guess what they're going to do? They're going to move more jobs offshore. So there's nothing that's really been proposed to raise corporate taxes, which would be, by the way, very un-neoliberal, but that's not happening, you see. And while they're talking about it for the family leave plan, this $3.5 trillion catch-all that remains from what they cut out of their first two bills, they meaning Biden and Democrats, while they're talking about that, I predict they're not going to raise taxes to pay for that either. Besides that, it probably will never get passed because the filibuster won't be eliminated, and the budget reconciliation with 50 plus one votes will happen because you got blue dog senators like Manchin and Sinema, and you got blue dog representatives, 11 of them, who will thwart passing, you know, the $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation. So I don't see anything that would break from neoliberal policies. Now, whether neoliberal policies can continue to function and you know keep the elites in power here remains to be seen. But I agree. Back to the original point, and that is, there's nothing, there's no break from neoliberal policies here in the Biden, you know, bills and programs. And it's Keynesian, but it's not Keynes, you see. There's a difference. What purports to be Keynesian economics is not what Keynes had to say. We can talk about that. That's a separate topic.
Well, I have to
actually step out, but I wanted to ask a final question, which I'll have to review later, which is, you know, we see these kind of high inflation numbers. You know, we see trailing inflation at like 5.4% for the previous year. How do you explain that coming out of a, you know, basically a very anomalous kind of recession? That's pretty unusual, right? How would you explain that level of inflation? Is that something that we need to be concerned about? And thank you so much for inviting me to the show. It's an honor to be on it. I'd love to have more time, but I have another thing I have to get to. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay. I'd be glad to address that question. First of all, you got to be clear, what's the base period for the inflation? In other words, in the first half of 2020, when COVID hit, companies cut their prices. We had deflation going on. And the numbers you're seeing now thrown about are year to year. In other words, from June of 2020 to June of 2021. So you start on a base of prices that had fallen, and then you say, okay, how much has inflation risen from that deflated base? And you get a number, right, which is the 3.4%, I think it is, if you use the index called the personal consumption expenditure, PCE, that the Fed uses. That's in, you know, the main indicator of inflation. The consumer price index is not an indicator of inflation. The CPI is an indicator of the cost of living in big cities. There's a difference. And the CPI excludes a whole number of things that should be included in it. And it, that way it keeps the number down. And so does the PCE. It keeps the number down. I would say that inflation is higher than they're reporting right now. And then the question comes, is it due to all this spending from these social programs? No, it's not a demand-driven, it's a supply-driven problem. We have these supply chain bottlenecks that are still very much with us around the world, and the goods cannot get into the United States here from China and so forth, or China is cutting back the delivery because they're falling into a recession. So we have a problem of supply side here for a lot of goods and services. On top of that, during last year, 2020, businesses pared down their inventories. So when things started to open up this spring, they did not have the inventories, the supply themselves domestically. So that drives up the prices. And then the third factor, I think, is there's just a lot of price gouging going on by businesses. Last year, they couldn't raise prices because people weren't buying a lot of things, particularly services. So now they're trying to recoup by jacking up prices even faster than before. And, you know, whether it's rents, people who rent know this is going on. People who pay utilities know this is going on. Your auto insurance, your home insurance, jacking up the prices. They're all double-digit price increases going on here across the board, even some foodstuffs. So there's a lot of price gouging to recover their losses. You add that to domestic supply, you add that to global supply chain problems, and yes, you got inflation going on, but it's a supply side phenomenon, not a demand side. Of course, Republicans like to make it a demand side thing. That's the way they can attack the social program spending that has been going on so far. But it's not a demand side. There's not that much spending that has actually already gotten into the economy. You know, when Biden passed his first bill here, the COVID Relief American Rescue Plan, you know, well, that was supposed to be $1.8 trillion, right? Well, the Congressional Budget Office estimated, oh, no, only $1 trillion would be spent this year, not $1.8 trillion, only one. And then that got further cut because they cut unemployment benefits, right? They didn't pay out the rent assistance. The checks didn't all get distributed. Money didn't all get to small businesses in the loans and grants. So the actual amount of money that's going to be spent from the rescue plan in February is somewhere around $800 billion. And then you got to divide that over the fact that we've only had 3 months of that, right? So it's only one fourth of that at most. And when you say, OK, maybe we hit $100 billion, $150 billion into the economy in an economy that's over $2 trillion, that's nothing in terms of demand stimulus, you see. So when you get into the details, yes, bottom line, we have inflation. Secondly, it's underestimated significantly, right? Third, it's a supply side, largely in a price gouging event, not really an event due to excess demand because of the social programs.
So basically what you're saying is that the COVID situation is making the distribution of the actual merchandise and goods and services difficult to be spread. And as a result, prices are going up, and the prices going up is what's causing that inflation. Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, something along those lines. That sort of comic crosses the three different examples I gave of why it's the supply side and a price gouging thing. It's a redistribution of income because the people who can't afford the rising prices for food and rent and utilities and insurances are mostly the working class, you know, those making median $40,000-$50,000 a year or less, you see, not those who are triple, digit 100,000-200,000 incomes, the top 10% of households and the labor force. That's the group that's been able to accumulate savings, you see. They put a lot of that savings, you hear a lot about, oh, the savings rate went way up, therefore we gave a lot of money. But it's all skewed to the top, to higher income levels. It's not the, you know, at the median level, which is, you know, the core of the working class level. It's at the very high level. So it doesn't make any difference that you have an increase in your savings rate or personal income increases going on, PI, personal income going up. What matters is disposable income for people at the median. And that has not increased very much. And now inflation is cutting into that deeply.
All right, we have about 7 minutes left, Dr. Rasmussen. We have a good question here. If you can answer this in 7 minutes, I'd be more impressed than I already am. What does Dr. Rasmussen think about modern monetary theory? Does it have a role to play in our economy? Or is this basically, I like to say, it could be kind of a shenanigans that the left is selling to itself. What are your thoughts as an economist on modern monetary theory, which is an economic philosophy proposed by many on today's left as a means out of our kind of, we're worried about inflation, we're worried about debt spending and deficits and so on and so forth. Can you first define it for our audience and explain what your thoughts are on it?
Well, as I understand it, then I'm still investigating it further. So my opinion's a work in progress. But modern money theory is saying that, the Fed only increases the money supply to bankers, right? And it only funnels through the banks to big corporations. Why shouldn't the Fed act like a public bank and provide funding, for investments and expenditures direct to people? Direct to small business, direct to households, and so forth, which is a way of saying, why doesn't the Fed act like a fiscal agent when the Congress won't? you see. It's really fiscal policy parading as monetary policy. But, you know, I'm not all that strong an advocate of monetary policy in general, because monetary policy means it's got to go through some financial institutions. It's got to go into lending. It's got to be taken up. You got to have money demand as well as money supply. And it's a conduit to stimulate the economy that has a lot of blockage, in my opinion. It's got to go through a lot of steps before it actually gets down to the people who need it. But my other view is, monetary policy really subsidizes the financial institutions along the way, you see. And it's a kind of trickle down, just like we have fiscal trickle down. We got monetary trickle down. So, I'm not a big advocate of that whole direction in general. And the other thing about, MMT that I wonder about is, MMT says, let's have the Fed do this. Let's have the monetary system do this, be the channel for providing money supply for everybody who may need it at all levels, not just bankers. That means you're going to have to turn the central bank, the Fed, into a totally different institution that's accountable to the people, not just to the bankers. And, the bankers like it the way it is, because everything's got to go through their pipeline, you see. And to get MMT, you'd have to make the Federal Reserve a public bank with a structure of lower level public banks throughout the country to take the money out into the rest of the economy. You're going to need a political revolution for that. The bankers will not allow that. You're going to have to change Congress significantly, and you're not going to do it with two wings of the corporate party America there now. It's kind of naive, I think. Where I agree with MMT is that deficits really don't matter. That proposition of their statement, in other words, they're saying deficits don't matter if the money generated that causes the deficit actually goes into real growth, goes down into the real economy. It will generate growth and activity that will offset the deficits. Well, that's also a kind of neoliberal argument, you see. The argument on the tax side, neoliberal tax side, is if we throw enough money at the businesses and the bankers, they will lend it out and they will invest it and it will generate jobs and income and more tax revenue. And make up for the tax cuts. The revenue flow will make up for the tax cuts. Well, that hasn't worked in reality. And I'm not so sure that the MMT argument that if you use the central bank as a kind of a vehicle of to provide money and lending for all of the economy, that necessarily will actually end up in real money demand, not just money supply. You see, that's what the Fed has no control. Central bank has no control over money demand. That has to do with the economy. You can provide all the money supply you want, but if conditions are such no one wants to borrow it, well, then it's not going to get out there into the economy. So, those three elements of MMT, I find very questionable. The political side of it, MMT, can it function as a central bank, as a public bank, deficits, the deficit argument, and the whole idea of pumping money into the economy through a banking vehicle, whether that's a nationalized banking system or whether it's a capital banking system that we have now. I'm not a big advocate of monetary policy, you see, for those reasons. Whether it's a brazen capitalist monetary policy or whether it's a progressive, a more democratic monetary policy.
Well, Professor Rabbit, I was wondering, can we get you to stay for our patrons only section? We'll send you a link to come on for at least a half hour of your time, if possible. Well, hopefully, we can do that and continue this conversation into the patrons-only section. Are you interested in doing such?
Sure, I'll be glad to do that. You're going to send me a different link.
Yes, I'm going to send you a different link.
And what is this, a Q&A kind of with your
audience? It's a Q&A with our patrons and a closer knit people who are more closely aligned with the show.
Okay.
And we'll have a few more questions in. But I'd like to thank you for coming on. Once again, we'd like to thank Ascitar Bear. And we will see our patrons in the patrons-only section. Please share the link to the show. Become a patron. Subscribe. And hit the likes. And for those of us who are watching, we are out.